Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 13-401, State v. Abogano. Arguing for petitioner, Titi Amaya N. Taase, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent, Lauren J. Thomas, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Taase and Ms. Thomas. Are you both ready to proceed? All right, and I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Taase, and we'll give you a 10-minute warning when the remainder of, at the end of your argument. I do note there are some minor children involved in this case. If it be possible to avoid mentioning them by their first name, if that's possible, I think it would be advisable. But if you cannot and you need to do that for the purpose of your argument, I guess go ahead. But I think, is that would that be a problem to simply refer to the one individual as the daughter? All right. Is that? But again, if that's going to impede your argument in any way, then of course you can refer to her by name. But okay.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Titi Maya Tarsen, on behalf of defendant petitioner appellant Scott Abogano. On behalf of Mr. Abogano, I thank this court for granting the application for writ of certiorari and allowing me to argue this case today on his behalf. Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices, before this court are three questions which arise out of the July 31st, 2014 summary disposition order issued by the Intermediate Court of Appeals, which I will address in order. And the first one has to deal with whether or not the trial court erred in precluding the period from February 11, 2013 to March 11, 2013 under Rule 48C8. And our position is that the trial court did err because under good cause, the trial judge's illness by itself did not give rise to a substantial reason which affords a legal excuse. Now, what a substantial reason which affords a legal excuse is...
I'm sorry to interrupt you so early, Mr. Taase, but you went directly to a point that seems to be a significant one in this case, that is whether the judge reporting to court ill, announcing that it's not possible to proceed, would in itself constitute a good cause, if you will, for some period of time. Say, for example, the day the judge reports to court for trial and is sick. Right? So could you clarify, did you mean to say that the, as a matter of law, good cause provision of 48C8 wouldn't apply even in that limited time period, that is the day the judge is there and says that he or she is sick?
Yeah, our position is that it doesn't apply to any time. That the illness alone, standing by itself, doesn't give rise to a reason to exclude any time under Rule 48C8.
What if the judge had been even too ill to appear in court that day?
If the judge had been too ill to appear in court that day, Your Honor, the calendar is still there. And I don't mean to sound like I'm not sympathetic to her illness, but you know the calendar is still there, and these cases need to be disposed of. And part of the reason why we said that doesn't give rise to a substantial reason is,
what if the judge next door just had to come over and just say, the judge, I have my own trial call calendar. This judge that has this trial call calendar is too ill. I'm just going to continue everything for one day while we try to figure everything out. You don't think that would even be good cause?
Had that happened, Your Honor, it may have been good cause because at least the court took some steps to sort of to try and take care of the delay by calling the judge from next door to come in and continue all the cases. If the judge from next door had come in and said, Judge Castagnetti is sick today, she can't appear for trial call. We've exhausted all of the efforts we could. We couldn't find a replacement judge in time. We've contacted the Chief Justice. We've contacted the Family Court Administrative Judge. We've contacted the District Court Administrative Judge. There just aren't any replacement judges available to come and hear the calendar. Then I think it would have been a good cause. And I think that's a, sorry, Justice.
Well, I was just going to ask, it seems that this case has been argued based on sickness, and maybe I'm missing something, but this case looks like to me it's court congestion. This is what this case is about. I mean, let me try to explain what I mean. This case wasn't continued a month because of her illness. The judge wasn't available to begin that day, maybe the next. We don't even know how long she was sick.
That's correct.
It's one thing to say a case is continued because someone's sick. But what happened, I mean, this case could have been continued the following week, 2 weeks, and it could have been within Rule 48. But what occurred here was a determination that because that judge couldn't be there for the trial beginning, that the trial was going to be put off for a month. Under that logic, you could have put off the case for a year. So I think what we're dealing with here is court congestion, actually, that the court was unable or didn't make an effort to try this case in the next, the following week or some other time period.
And with regards to court congestion, had there been any findings put on the record about some sort of temporary imbalance between the caseload and the dispositions of the court and any of the other factors like I've already gone over, maybe then it could have been considered a court congestion, but none of that, the state didn't ask that it be congested out or didn't ask that the time be excluded for court congestion due to exceptional circumstances.
Mr. Tasek, can you explain, I know you mentioned what you thought a neighboring judge in the next courtroom come in, but clearly it's undisputed that the judge was sick in this case.
That's correct.
So the judge, because she was there, what do you think she was obligated to put on the record?
I think what she's obligated to put on the record, and this is what defense counsel asked, is it our understanding you're not going to make any findings with regards to Rule 48, at least put on, she was ill, some of the steps that she took to try to find a replacement judge.
And what are the steps you think that she should have done to find a replacement judge?
We put in our brief, HRS 603-41, which confers the authority to the Chief Justice to, find a replacement judge. And if she had tried to call or ask just the judge next door if he could possibly accommodate the trial, because the trial in this case lasted 2 days. It started on March 12th, it ended March 13th. So she said she would try to come back on Thursday to see if she was feeling better. And at that time, if she wasn't feeling better and the trial couldn't be had, and she asked the court next door if they had any trials that were going that week or if they could accommodate the trials that were ready to go.
How far should the trial court have gone? What about a courtroom two doors down? What about the other criminal judges? What about the civil judge? If there's a court, is there an obligation to see if there is a court that can try the case?
I think so. I think, under Herrera, the court can take judicial notice of the prevailing policy that cases can be moved between judges in order to alleviate congestion and also to make sure that these trials are dealt with expediently.
I'm just wondering, I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
How sick could the judge have? What if the judge was really, really sick? You think that she should have to get off the bench and, what if she thought she was having a stroke, but she wasn't, but she would have to come off the bench and start making these calls. And, how this works on the eighth floor. I mean, the other judges are probably in the courtroom. You think she should have to come out, wait until they take a break and say, are you available? Or, what if the judge is really, really sick? How far does she have to go?
I think there has to be at least something on the record where some steps were taken. Nothing, in the record, there's nothing. There's nothing about any steps.
Even if she thinks it's emergent, that she has an emergent situation, she has to take steps and avoid going to the hospital right away.
I think that's an extreme case. What happened here was, she said she had the flu and she was able to come to court. I think the first trial judge, Judge Castagnetti, could have called and seen if there was a replacement judge available.
I think you're putting the responsibility on the wrong judge. If the judge is sick on that day and the judge doesn't know and the judge appears, the judge has every right at that point. But the question is what happens afterwards when the motion is heard? I mean, after the parties are notified, look, we can't go forward. Then the time comes for the administrative judge or somebody else to step in and try to see if another judge is available. And apparently, what we have is nothing was done because this thing got continued to the very day that the first judge continued it. And then the only finding we have is a trial, is the motions judge saying there are no replacement judges, period. That sounds like court congestion, saying we have no resources absolutely whatsoever. I'm going to take judicial notice. We don't have to check with any other judge. And we're not in a good cause provision. We are in whether or not there's sufficient judicial resources and whether or not, under Herrera, factual circumstances were demonstrated to justify that.
And if that was the case, Your Honor, those circumstances are absent from the record in this case.
What should the record have included? Don't say something like, I did something.
Right.
If you want us to make a rule, what should the rule say?
I think, you know, if we look at the cases under C2, it should put forward some sort of findings about these judges were unavailable.
You know. So every judge that was contacted and the fact that they were unavailable and why?
Well, I think, you know, under Herrera and Barron and Steve E. Lord, the findings that were entered in that case, those are the kinds of things that the court should have put on the record at that time, and it failed to do so.
Which is
under that the congestion was caused by the fact that some judges had retired, some judges were on vacation, there was an absence of possible replacement judges at that time. Things of that nature.
Mr. Tosse, what would be your recommendation as to whether, based on the error, the Rule 48 error, there should be a hearing on remand? Or are you suggesting that this is a basis for a new trial, that is, a hearing in which these issues can be explored more fully?
I think that the case at that point, you know, should have been dismissed with or without prejudice, you know, at the court's discretion.
So what's the remedy you're looking for now?
I don't want to go into it further, but I think the remedy is that the conviction should be vacated and this case should be remanded to the trial court back to the circuit court to dismiss with or without prejudice.
In that case, would it be necessary to address your other issues that you've raised with your cert?
If the court is going to, on that issue alone, you may not need to, in my opinion, Your Honor, but I think that it's important issues to get into. And with regards to...
May I ask you, in this particular case, it was probably, we don't know for sure, but it's probably set for trial at that particular point because Rule 48 is about to expire in a couple of weeks, right?
Well, it was set in Courtroom 8C because that when it goes to Courtroom 8D, they either send it to Courtroom 8B or 8C.
So was Rule 48 about to expire?
It was. You know, the issue of Rule 48 came up early in the proceedings.
I'm just asking you factually. Right. Was it about ready to expire?
From what point? From the February 11th date? Or from
when were the 6 months going to run?
It was going to run on February 26th.
Okay. So it seems like in this particular instance, as a matter of course, the judge continued it onto the calendar for 1 month.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And is that just what they normally do if something gets...
Yeah, that's the usual practice,
okay.
But...
So are you saying that maybe in instances where the Rule 48 is about to run sooner, which in this case was about 2 weeks, should it be heard... Should there be a mechanism by which all the other circuit court judges are contacted to see whether they could take the case within the next 2 weeks?
I'm not saying that there should be this mechanism, but it could have been continued for just a week to the next week. And, you know, that has been done before on the eighth floor. The state brings up the issue of Rule 48, and the case is set before the Rule 48 deadline.
You said this was brought up to Judge Castagnetti, right?
It was twice, Your Honor. On February 11th, the first time the case was called, she asked when is the Rule 48 date, and the state said February 26th.
So, I mean, at the time that she was sick and going to continue it, she knew that it was going to run in 2 weeks and she would go for 1 month?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can I ask a follow-up on, I think, what Justice Nakayama is talking about, that perhaps the case could have been handled maybe in priority setting. When it did come back a month afterwards, wasn't there, it appeared that they were going to set it off a month, but the prosecutor, I think, brought it to the court's attention. Look, we have to take this case earlier, and they actually gave it a priority, which could have been done actually a month earlier.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it was actually, it was set third in the lineup for the week where it actually did go to trial, but it did eventually go to trial. And I think that serves, that this, anything can really happen. Had it been sent over to Judge Sotol, the other FCCR judge, who knows, he may have had other cases that were set for trial, but sometimes these cases fall off. Sometimes people change their plea. They decide they don't want to go to trial. Complaining witnesses don't show up. Cases have to be continued. And sometimes the third case, the fourth case, the fifth case is the one that actually goes to trial. But I think we have to at least try or show something in the record that shows that you try to accommodate the trial.
But is it your position that the judge's illness standing alone could not even justify like a 1 week continuance? So the judge is ill. Everyone agrees that the judge is ill. The case is continued for 1 week. That cannot constitute good cause.
I don't think that time period should be excluded from Rule 48 calculation.
You think even so, if you do not agree to 1 week, you obviously would not agree to the 1 day that I suggested earlier.
That's correct.
So if the Rule 48 was to run the next day, here we're talking about one count TRO violation. What if this was a murder case?
I think under Rule 48 doesn't differentiate between the type of charge. It just says plainly that these cases have to be brought to trial.
You don't think that if this was a murder case that one judge had been responsible for all the pretrial motions in limine, and you're saying that the judiciary would be no good cause to continue that trial until that judge recovered?
I think under that those circumstances that you're saying, Justice McKenna, it's hard really for me to gauge, because in my mind, all these motions that had to be disposed of should have been disposed of before.
What I'm saying is that that judge had already, this is a murder trial, the judge had already done all the pretrial rulings, all the pretrial motions in limine, everything had been decided. Rule 48 is to run the next day. And jury selection was to start that day. So you're saying that that judge falls very ill and is unable to do the trial. You've argued that a judge's illness in and of itself can never be good cause. Are you saying that that would apply even in that situation?
If the illness was coupled with something else, not just something else, but some of the reasoning and the factors that were laid out in cases like Barron, Lord, and Herrera, I think you could exclude it for good cause.
So your position really, it's not automatic. I mean, that's what you were arguing before, was there had to be some circumstances placed on the record. And I think at least one thing I don't agree with is that those circumstances don't have to be put on the very same day, because a judge may not be well enough to do so.
That's correct. And then when we came to, when the motions judge heard it, at that time, when he said there are no replacement judges, I don't think that was a finding. If you read that passage in context, he was meaning to say that judges, just like defense attorneys, are not fungible. And we know that's not true. That's why we have this prohibition on forum shopping, because right. any judge can sit and listen to a trial and be judicious and be professional about it.
Because I'm going to ask you what needs to be, instead of something used to be said, right. What needs to be put on the record? Now, you know that all circuit court judges sit as courts in general jurisdiction, all of them in the state could step in and do this case, civil, criminal, family. And also, you know that district court judges can be sit in circuit court by assignment. So what does the judge have to put on the record in order for it to constitute good cause to exclude the time?
I think, you know, the case that was cited to by the ICA, which is United States v. Ferris, where the judge's illness, you know, the judge's illness could be grounds for a continuance. But under the Federal Speedy Trial Act, you know, it says there no continuance can be granted unless the trial judge or the ruling judge puts on the record reasons why the need for the continuance, the interest of justice sought by granting the continuance, overrule the interests of the public and the defendant in a right to speedy trial.
Please answer my question. What does the trial court, instead of just put something on the record, what does the trial judge need to, how many judges does the trial judge need to contact in order to justify good cause to exclude the time?
I don't think there's any number, Your Honor. I think just that they've taken the steps to call at least the Chief Justice, the head of the family court, or the head of the district court to see if there are any replacement judges, and then put on the record, you know, why, you know, the interests of justice outweigh the right of the defendant under Rule 48 in the interests of the public. My time is winding down, but you know that I'm sorry that the state also asked the state in its opening briefs that this should be reviewed under an abuse of discretion. And when the motion was brought up, the court, Mr. Abregano, had a facially valid reason why the case should be dismissed for Rule 48. At that time, the burden shifted to the state to show that periods were excludable. At no time did the motions judge ever ask the state to chime in, ever give any legal arguments. The court itself never espoused any of its legal reasoning, never delved any further into Abregano's legal reasoning. When trial counsel attempted to argue, you know, abstention, attempted to argue the fact that there are other circuit court justices available, you know, she was pretty much shut down by the trial.
Are you suggesting it's not a review for abuse of discretion? Because isn't that what Distencion said? Well, it's highly deferential, or certainly it's reviewed for abuse of discretion. I guess I won't say highly deferential, but
I think that the standard of review, the proper standard of review, is right wrong. But I know that the state argued an abuse of discretion.
So would we have to overrule Estencion? Because I think that case was to disturb the trial court's discretion only if a clear case of abuse or the court's ruling is arbitrary and capricious.
Well, I think that under either standard, under the right or wrong or the abuse of discretion, I think the trial court erred in this matter. And that's, you know, this goes into the second issue that we talked about with regards to the improper comment on the evidence, whether or not Mr. Abregano received a fair trial before an impartial and unbiased judge. I take issue with the ICA because when we review for judicial bias, we look at the record as a whole. And I think the ICA looked at the transcript and the record in a piecemeal fashion. First off, when the circuit court interjected itself into the state's questioning of the mother in this case, you know, it came at a very critical time. Now, the defense's theory in this case was both reasonable doubt and ignorance or mistake of fact. And at the time, the questioning where the state was trying to take it was trying to establish facts that would negate the ignorance or mistake of fact and reasonable doubt. They're asking, you know, what did Judge Kupala tell you at the hearing? That was an objection, hearsay, sustained. Who's covered under this order? Objection, hearsay, sustained. And at that point, with the jury watching, the court said, isn't this covered on page 1 of Exhibit 1? If so, publish it to the jury at this time. And when you look at the arguments made by the state in its opening and its closing, the only arguments it made to negate state mistake or ignorance or mistake of fact was that Mr. Abregano was there at the hearing and was read to him twice. There was no other evidence adduced about what happened at that hearing or anything.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Ticasse, but could you help me with that point that you're making about the nature of your defense being a mistake of fact. Now, in this case, the charge seems to be a prohibited distance charge, that is, whether or not there was a violation of the protective order because the defendant was within the prohibited distance under the protective order, correct? And then you were making the point about how there was a mistake of fact being argued. So what was specifically the mistake of fact that you're suggesting the defendant had? What mistake was it? What fact was he mistaken about?
Well, the mistake was that whether or not the term petitioner or petitioner other protected persons are synonymous under the order. And if it was, he was mistaken to he was mistaken as to his belief that the two were differentiated. Under
with
the order.
Respect to the stepdaughter.
With regards to the stepdaughter, that's correct. And it's, well, I cited to State v. Creel and, you know, the other case like State v. Tanaka. You know, this wasn't an issue of mere semantics. This was the central issue in the trial at that time. And the ICA said that the court was just trying to expedite the process. Well, you know, all of these things are really interrelated with the bias and the improper comment, and also the Silva case. Does the judge have the right under 614 to ask questions of a witness? Absolutely it does, but it cannot use that power to become an advocate for one side or show bias or prejudice against one side or the other.
Unlike Silva, of course, there wasn't any questioning by the judge in this case, so you're suggesting that statements by the judge affected your mistake of fact defense. Your mistake of fact defense was that the defendant was mistaken with respect to whether the protective order covered the stepdaughter, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what about the statement of the judge affected that defense? What about the statement of the judge related to or was relevant to the notion that the defendant was mistaken in his interpretation of the protective order that it covered the stepdaughter?
Well, the judge himself says, if you want to ask her who's covered, I believe that's on page one of exhibit one and published that to the jury. So you have to look at where the prosecutor was trying to take the questioning at that time, and he was trying to take it to establish facts that would negate the mistake of fact.
And the defense attorney had just finished opening, said that was the issue in the case, and the judge apparently tells the jury, your answer's on the top of the form, and you read the form, and it's completely ambiguous who's covered.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Actually, it's really not that ambiguous. Actually, in this case, the judge appears to have erred, correct? The stepdaughter is not one of the petitioners in
that's
this
what,
case.
That's what we,
but the judge was very clear in denying the motion for judgment of acquittal that, you know, he said he had issued orders for protection in district court, and when other protected persons, they mean the same meaning as a petitioner in the court's eyes, so they're not, they may not be listed as other protected persons. And so he even went as far as to tell the defense counsel that as far as the court is concerned, other protected persons stand in the same shoes as petitioners. If defense counsel attempted to argue that these people were not protected persons under this order for protection, he would shut her down to say that this is a misstatement of the law and a misstatement of the document. But actually, when you look at the document, it's very clear that the minor is not one of the people subject to the distance prohibition.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. That's what we attempted to argue. And basically, the judge was telling her that you can't argue reasonable doubt. You can't argue that this was prohibited conduct because, from my experience, I know this to be true. And when he denied the motion for judgment of acquittal, he never once talked about any of the evidence that was deduced from the testimony of the mother, the daughter, or the police officer.
Mr. Tosse, is it your understanding that the point that Justice McKenna made, that is the point about the judge's concern of this defense, was a reason that the judge suggested he might call Judge Kupal? In other words, to address the issue of whether the protective order covered the stepdaughter?
Yeah, I think that's a VP call. He didn't think that that mistake or ignorance or mistake of fact was applicable in this case. And if he had to clear it up, he would call Judge Kupal down to testify and clarify the order. Now, under 614, does the judge have the right to call his own witnesses? Yes, but you can't use that power to do exactly what the judge in this case threatened to do, which was to confirm one of the allegations, one of the essential elements of the crime against the defense or against the defendant, and to negate his theory of the defense, which was ignorance or mistake of fact.
And in fact, when the judge referred the prosecutor to that page, it was specifically when the state was asking about Section 3B3 of the order for protection, which is the prohibition of a respondent coming within 100 yards of any residence or place of employment or school of the petitioner.
That's correct.
And the question before that was, for the contact between parties section, did Judge Kupal say that it went over, that it covers both just you or you and the other people on the order for protection? And this is questioning of the mother. And the defense counsel objected on hearsay, of course, sustained. And then the court just directed the prosecutor to page one.
That's correct.
In response to who was covered.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I apologize. I see I'm out of time. So.
Well, we'll give you a little bit of time in rebuttal since we've been taking up your time that you reserved with questions. But at this point, is there anything further you'd like to raise?
Or?
Okay, well, we'll hear from Ms. Thomas then.
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Lauren Thomas on behalf of the state. I've been around quite some time practicing, and so as I recall, I saw the demise of the court congestion as really a valid or acceptable, I should say, exclusion. I think it might have ended sometime in the 1990s. The state's position, though, in this case is that, and I understand the lack of findings and the concern from this court, which, in all honesty, I can probably attribute to the high volume that these particular courtrooms deal with, as opposed to maybe the civil courtroom, which I don't mean as any disparagement on the civil courts, but this is a high volume courtroom. My understanding is for these two courtrooms that handle all of these for this particular island, that on Monday, I understand, is our calendar call, two courtrooms, each courtroom hearing or dealing with on that day, 20 to 25 cases.
Excuse me, are you adding to the record what isn't there?
No, I'm not, because I recognize it's not there, Your Honor, and I recognize that this court has a concern with maybe Judge Ochiai's failure to note maybe the circumstances they're dealing with, other than to just say we don't have any replacement judges that he's aware of.
Are you suggesting that on the, you know, adult family court, adult criminal calendar, cases are never transferred back and forth, or that the judges there never seek replacement judges in the event there is a Rule 48 violation, potential Rule 48 violation?
Well, my understanding is that there may be judges who come to sit in temporarily when a judge has a scheduled vacation, but based on Judge Ochiai's remarks in this case, I'm not aware, and it wasn't articulated that when a judge is sick, they can just pick up the phone. I guess they're next calling the administrative judge when Justice Nakayama was asking, well, what should a judge do? On these facts, it's going to be difficult maybe to say. I mean, this judge said she had the flu. Usually the flu is something that in a short amount of time, you're probably going to be flat on your back. I don't know whether you're capable of making calls. Now, whether this particular court handling these cases has some kind of administrative measure in place to address these situations, obviously that's not on the record, so we don't know. Would it be a good thing? Certainly, because it's a functioning a function of judiciary administratively, at least for that court, and I guess that would be Judge Browning, who is over the family courts, including these two.
Well, what about Mr.
Taase's
suggestion is unreasonable. He suggests the Chief Justice, the head of family court, and I believe he said the Deputy Chief Judge, to inquire as to whether there are other judges available. Is that unreasonable?
Well, it didn't sound unreasonable. I mean, we don't know on this record whether something was done and they already had a plan in place that when Judge Ochiai said we don't have replacement judgment.
Well, I think judges, what Mr. Taase is saying is if it was put on, something has to be put on the record. Would you agree with that?
I think in cases like this, being at the appellate level, of course, because the appellate court, what do they have to review? You know, you need something to review to judge the reasonableness of what the court, what action the lower courts took. So as an appellate attorney for many years, yes, certainly. And
no, I mean, it gets difficult because we have a judge who put off the trial for 1 month. And my question seriously was, could have been 3 months or 6 months or something like that. And to follow up, I guess the other concern, you know, it's, we're all sympathetic, of course, to a judge who gets sick, but I mean, suppose that it would be, the rationale would have been maternity leave or paternity leave or funeral leave or sick, or I mean, there's so many types, or leave for a child to go to the conference. I mean, these are the kinds of things that all could arise, and it seems that I'm not so sure unanticipated fits.
I understand what you're saying, Justice Pollack, but I think the distinction would be with paternity, maternity. I mean, hopefully so. You have noticed well in advance, and you can make arrangements with your supervisory court. In this case, I guess it would be Judge Browning. Here's the plan in place. Now, this case, we have a judge who's ill, who comes in that morning with the flu. It wasn't a cold, maybe something building up. She felt she had the flu, which probably meant she wanted to get home as soon as possible. But she showed up that morning to address probably the 20 to 25 cases she had on her calendar. So is the record lacking in that respect? A bit, but I think we at least have something to work with in the sense that Judge Ochiai was aware that in this circumstance where a judge is sick, we don't have any replacement judgment.
So the maternity leave, there might be judges to replace, but if a judge is sick for a few days with the flu, we don't have any replacements the entire time frame.
It's more an emergency situation, Your Honor.
But for the entire time frame. Because
sick leave
may apply for that first few days, but after that, we're not talking sick. We're under a different exception.
And Your Honor, I understand that's where the findings would be helpful. What is the situation they're dealing with there? Are they dealing with exceptional circumstances with the volume of cases they have in those two courtrooms hearing the abuse calendar, the misdemeanor abuse calendar? But in this case, I suspect, I know it's not on the record, but I expect this is the normal course for this type of reason.
Well, let me ask you this. Yes. So they went over the 180 days by 2 weeks. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe co-counsel is correct. It was about the 25th or the 26th.
So in your view, I mean, what we have on the record is that the judge was sick. Is that fact alone enough to justify, you know, I think Justice Pollack suggests that a couple of days might be, just based on the illness of the judge, might be good cause. What about 2 weeks? I guess that's the key question in this case, because really all we have on the record is that the judge was sick.
Yeah, and then we're talking specifics of an illness, because while a flu might knock someone on their back for a couple days, well, I don't know anybody that knocks on their back a couple days that they don't get pneumonia for that, but I think 2 weeks, especially from what I've heard of this more virulent strain that is not, the current vaccine is not effective against.
Different flu.
Yeah, and so
doesn't it really depend on the calendar?
I absolutely agree with you, Justice McKenna.
Right.
This is not the same calendar that other courtrooms are facing. I think other
But as a practical matter, on that calendar, if a judge is going to be out for more than a week, replacement judges are brought in.
That's my understanding.
I've
seen him in transcripts.
This judge could have just continued this trial call until the next week. And we would have been within Rule 48.
I don't, because there's nothing on the record, and even if looking outside of that, I don't know how that particular courtroom functions administratively, or I should say the domestic violence misdemeanor calendar, which are the two courtrooms over on the eighth floor. My understanding is they have replacement judges when a judge is going to go on vacation. But if a judge is calling in sick, or at least in this case, to her credit, Judge Castagnetti showed up, and given how ill she was probably feeling, that she felt she couldn't even start a trial that day, because if she could have started it and then furthered it, I know we get all the issues with the jury, but...
She continued, oh, that's right, it was Tuesday. Yeah. It was the trial day that she actually continued it.
It started it,
right.
And then we would have been okay on Rule 48.
Ms. Thomas?
Yes,
I know that you have focused on the idea of administrative need that the courts have, and as Justice McKenna has said, that seems to be a pretty significant issue here. These are domestic violence courts that actually are dedicated courts full-time, right?
Yes, they are.
And I'm sure that's something that's ringingly clear to your office, since you have so many hardworking deputies that are working full-time. There aren't a lot of courts that are dedicated to one subject matter, and in this case we have two judges dedicated entirely to the subject matter, and you have prosecutors dedicated to those courtrooms, correct?
We do.
So I know that your office has been quite helpful for us in making determinations about when Rule 48 is approaching, and I know that's your common practice. So with that said, how would you characterize your office's approach to those cases that are approaching a domestic violence trial that have a Rule 48 potential problem? Is there a point at which you are alerted and you are taking the initiative to help assist in case a judge can't proceed at a particular trial date? Because I don't think this is an unusual occurrence where for some reason a case with a Rule 48 date problem can't go forward. So to what extent does your office keep track of this and participate when it looks like the issue is going to be a live one before the judge?
Okay, well, just I think generally speaking, Justice Wilson, I don't think it's a secret to do is read the media. And these cases are very important to our prosecuting attorney, very important. He puts an utmost priority on these. And the marching orders are to get these things done. And
exactly. In a case like this, mm-hmm. certainly is a potential responsibility for the prosecutor's office as well. And I know that you take Rule 48 seriously, but I guess it's a message about also attempting to make arrangements with the courts ahead of time in case there's a backup that's needed.
I agree with you, Justice Wilson. I think their concerns have been expressed, but as it also comes down to an administrative function of the court.
Yes, it certainly is, and it's a responsibility essentially.
That respect and deference to how the court.
Sure,
I'm sorry,
you're right.
I'm sorry
it's a responsibility of the court, number one. But assuming that the case is remanded on the basis of a Rule 48 dismissal, would you find it necessary for the court to reach the other two issues that are raised in this circuit?
Well, if it's going to be remanded back with for consideration of a dismissal with or without prejudice, I would hope.
Assuming it was remanded with an anticipated new trial.
I don't know that this court would necessarily deal with a very important 606B issue that it may potentially be here, because it's also arisen in other cases that I'm aware are pending. And it's a significant issue. I mean, it's a question, I think, that even when you look at this record, and I'll just say this briefly because this court may not want to even hear from me on the issue, but it became apparent to me doing all the research that this question has really vexed courts across the country. And I understand the federal rules of evidence, different than ours, I understand that. But it, in reading all the case law, it is certainly a question that has vexed courts about how far they can go to opening verdicts to attack based on circumstances. And I don't even want to say such as this because I have a different view on the conduct here as it relates to 606B, but just other types of conduct. I mean, I think this court was very clear in Bailey, in Kim, and some other cases where I think it's really been clarified over the years, but there, it is a question I think vexes courts across the country.
Well, was there anything wrong to have this jury testify as to whether or not that the judge's basically instruction to the prosecutor, whether that was discussed? That certainly isn't improper under Rule 606, right?
Not whether it's discussed. You're absolutely correct, Justice Paul.
So a situation where the court creates the error, you get a juror communication specifically on that issue, you get a discussion that's apparently disclosed to counsel that this matter apparently came up, and the defense files a new trial, and the judge says, oh, we don't allow jurors to talk about those kind of things. I understand that there may have been a reference to possible effect, but I think the exact words were, I don't know if I have a notion, but the judge could have said, look, I'll allow the jury to talk, but the jury's only going to be able to talk if something was said, not to effect. The court could have done that.
I don't think in this case, Justice Pollack, that I understand the comments that the judge made, which I don't think exhibit bias or were improper. So then the question I had is, and this is a far question, but is this even technically an outside influence?
It's part of the evidence, right?
It's kind of, exactly.
It's in court.
Yeah, it's not the kind of contact with court personnel that's been problematic in the past. I think it was Estrada, maybe, where the judge.
Well, I mean, you can have a 404 issue where the judge tells the jury to disregard, and it occurs in court, and the judge tells the jury to disregard. And if there's evidence, independent evidence, that the jury talked about that, that wouldn't be something that could
maybe
be.
Maybe might. I'm sorry, Justice Paul.
No, I'm just. That, isn't that something that the judge would be able to inquire about?
Certainly, but I don't think that defendant made a prima facie showing here. I don't think he showed something or some conduct that rose to the level that the trial court needed to do a fuller exploration of what happened.
Well,
I'm sorry,
go ahead, Justin.
If this case is remanded, is the state going to continue to take the position that sections 3B3 and 3B4 of the order for protection apply to the minor?
My understanding is when I was reviewing the closing argument, Justice McKenna, is that the deputy was arguing the no contact to the mother, right, and within so many feet, and then the other one is so many yards. And then I think that they were even arguing not necessarily the distance to the child.
Actually,
the,
you raise a very good point. The deputy seemed to be raising at least six bases on which the deputy believed the restraining order had been, order for protection had been violated, including contacting the mother, contacting the minor, and then coming within 100 yards of the minor, and then 100 feet of the minor, and let's see.
Yes, Ms. Thomas, right. In the actual opening, it's argued by the prosecutor to the jury that it, referring to the protective order, says that respondent is prohibited from coming or passing within 100 feet of the petitioner, and then it says the evidence also prohibits him from having contact with the minor. So it's specifically argued in the opening. I mean, the idea that this is a prohibited distance type of charge, that is the distance within which the defendant was to the minor, is prohibited under the protective order was clearly the basis of the charge. And then, and that is what was responded to in the opening by the defense when the defense said the evidence will show that there was no term that said he had to be 100 feet away from Hazelin. So this seems to be the gravamen of the mistake of fact defense that was addressed by the circuit court judge when the circuit court judge said that the protective order covers the minor as well as the mother in front of the jury.
Actually, the reason for my question was the state was raising all these different alleged bases. This is a one-count complaint. I did not see any Arceo instruction, so and I didn't see any election by the prosecutor. So what do you, if this case is remanded, what is the state going to continue to argue that 3B3 and 3B4 apply to the minor?
Well, what the deputy argued in open, or what the deputy stated in his opening statement, I think.
Actually, he expanded on that in the closing argument.
His closing, you're right. It was expanded because he included a lot more of.
It appears that the only possible alleged violation here is contact with the minor.
The verbal contact.
Well, right.
Right, because I don't. My recollection is that the deputy was focusing on that verbal contact, and that's how the testimony came out.
Actually, the mother also alleged that the respondent defendant was within 30 to 40 feet,
correct. Yes.
Of her.
Yes.
So as Justice McKenna said, there were six different theories argued, and two, I can't even figure out who the victim is in this case. I don't know who the complainant is. There's no finding as to who the complainant is. The charge doesn't say it. Instruction doesn't say it, and we have said at least three different times, we've said when you have a situation like that, it's plain error on its face. This is Cordillera, this is Getz, we just did it last year again in a memorandum opinion, that the court has to give a unanimity instruction as to the identity of the victim, and that did not occur here.
Okay, I recall, Justice Pollack, reviewing the settlement of jury instructions, and there was some discussion about the unanimity, whether it was general versus the specific.
There's nothing on one doesn't know who the victim is in this case.
Well, I think, actually, I would have to disagree with that, Justice Pollack. I think that the state's primary focus was on the contact with the child. But I understand what you're saying. There is some,
I can read you
there's
closing,
some overlap in the closing.
The closing. The prosecutor argues both of them. It's clear. It says page 39. Why is this a violation of the order of protection? It violates a number of items in this order of protection, starting with 3B. He's prohibited from contacting the petitioner. This is KA. Then the next paragraph. He's also prohibited from passing within 100 years of the petitioner. And then he talks about HL on the softball team. So, as Justice McKenna, there's six different theories, two different complainants, and the court's instruction doesn't even specify who the victim is.
Well, that not being the focus, Your Honor, of the opening briefs, the pleadings, it's just my recollection that when I did read the closing, I did have to read it closely to understand what the prosecutor was focusing on. It seemed through the questioning and defense's closing and their questioning of their witnesses and also the state's cross-examination of them that it was about the contact, verbal contact by defendant to the minor.
If you could at this point address the issue of the trial judge's comment or referring the prosecuting attorney to the actual order of protection. Do you feel that did that tilt the scales in favor of the state? And if you believe it did not, could you explain why?
I don't believe it did, Chief Justice Lechtenwald. And the reason for is for this. When you look at the record as a whole, I think sometimes we as counsel, and I'll include myself in that, will take more from a judge's comment than I think a juror would. I really do. I honestly believe that. And I think sometimes we put more emphasis on it than what the jury may have even thought. And potentially, you know, if they may have not had a good impression of the prosecutor. But that aside, I don't think, when you look at the whole record of this case, I don't think there's any bias or intemperate behavior by the judge coming through the transcript based on other cases I have read. And as it was pointed out, he didn't question any jurors. I think what he was doing, and he explained it during the motion for mistrial, because it was at that point that defense counsel brought it up, not at the moment it happened, because in retrospect, she said she didn't want to highlight it in the courtroom. But I think, you know, if they really believe that, then they should ask to approach the bench and risk maybe, you know, the judge's ire a little bit, but it'll be outside of the presence of the jury in a bench conference or wherever. And can ask for an instruction saying, you know, judge, maybe I am taking this the wrong way, but I perceive it this way. That's the way to put
was
it on the
record. Was the judge responsive to that argument when she tried to make it at the motion for judgment of acquittal?
He wasn't particularly pleased with the argument, I think, because I think he felt that it was, and it could also be that he didn't believe that that was his intention to come across that way. And that he had no motive that way other than what he said, that he's not going to just, you know, there's a fine line, well, not a fine line, there's a line between meddlesomeness and inaction.
Didn't
by a
judge
child.
Did he say he was going to call the other judge if he had to? I mean, isn't this a situation?
I think that was a different conversation.
I understand.
But yes. I understand how that there were one or two comments, I think, that may cause you to look more closely at it, but I think when you look at the record as a whole, I don't think there was any behavior that exhibited bias or prejudice against one side or the other.
Could I ask for your help
yes,
on that,
Justice
Ms. Thomas? Because when you say look at the record as a whole, and therefore maybe look at the record around the point at which the judge interjected and made the statement about the protective order, shortly after that when the motion for judgment of acquittal is being made, and the judge, looking at the record as a whole and trying to understand what the judge's intent was when he made that statement about the protective order as to the record or the exhibit showing the coverage of the protective order. Right after that, the judge says in response to the motion for judgment of acquittal that so far as the court is concerned, other protected persons stand in the same shoes as a petitioner in this case. So it seems, looking at the record as a whole, that you might suggest that that's what was in his mind when he made the statement about the protective order in front of the jury. So help me with that.
Well, I have to say in all honesty, Justice Wilson, I'd like to give our judges more credit than that. And I don't mean any disrespect, right?
Well, I'm asking your help.
Yeah,
so I'm happy to go along with you there if you could just give me your analysis about how that there's something else in the record that would suggest that that wasn't in his mind when he made a statement sua sponte on this very issue in front of the jury.
I think there was some argument going on back and forth between him and the deputy public defender. And at one point, the judge was concerned about a legal argument she was trying to assert. But I'm not sure they were on the same page, because she was talking more about a mistake of fact defense, but I didn't see that mistake of fact defense really come out in the questioning of the defendant, because he never said he was mistaken. When the defense counsel argued in their closing, they were saying the mistake was the minor's mistake, that she misheard, and there's a lot of commotion going on and a lot of people. So I didn't see in the end that a mistake of fact defense was really
presented. He had told her, the judge had told her at the motion for judgment of acquittal after the state's evidence, that he wasn't even going to let her argue that other argument.
Yeah, and I'd like to, it's hard to get a read on that, Justice McKenna. I know what you're saying, but I don't think it's so clear that they were necessarily on the same page and that the judge was shutting her down on a defense. Because then defendant testified and his testimony actually made sense with respect to the defenses she was trying to assert, that he was there, he admitted he was there, but that he didn't call out to her. And he had his mom testify, and if I'm not mistaken, he had his father testify.
Do you concede there's an Arceo issue here?
No, I'm not prepared to concede that, Justice McKenna. I do recall in the record seeing the parties discuss the unanimity instruction.
You saw that the defense had requested an Arceo instruction? But apparently the standard Arceo instruction was withdrawn by the judge.
Unanimity instruction, right. I mean, I cannot recollect right now. I remember seeing the discussion in the transcript, Justice McKenna. I can't remember whether they specifically had the Arceo in there. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I see my time is almost up. We didn't get much to the...
You still have time, so if you wish to continue discussing that issue, you can.
Well, given this concerns, this court's concerns on the Rule 48, I'm not sure the court would be inclined to visit then the 606B issue because it would essentially be moot and perhaps just more along the lines of an advisory opinion. But I saw it as an important issue, and I think that it was handled correctly. But you're exactly right, Justice Pollack. The Hawaii law is that you can inquire into the deliberative process only to the extent that you're asking about the nature of the conduct and whether it was used against defendant. And the analysis goes on for many layers about, you know, of course you can't ask the question about what effect, but in this case, I think the trial court handled it correctly. It may have, you know, wasn't a long, detailed written analysis or a written order, rather, an oral note. But I think
it was fairly abrupt.
I think, and that may have been more so, Your Honor, just because 606B, and all of a sudden he's got concerns, because the comment that defense counsel represented, or in defense counsel's proffer, was that she recalled the statement or the comment, and it had an influence on her. So that latter part of that can't even be considered under 606B. So then all we have is the comment, in which that comment could have meant any number of things. And I don't think it was a sufficient showing by defense that a fuller exploration needed to be done and to call in even that one juror. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thomas. Mr. Taase, I'll give you a couple minutes for a rebuttal.
With regards to the 606B issue, Justice Pollack, you're correct. The judge could have limited the scope of the inquiry to comply with 606. There could have been a fuller exploration, but in this case, there was no exploration. When defense counsel came for the motion, the first time for the motion for the new trial, the judge tells her, well, she tells the judge, I plan on calling Ms. Correa. The judge says, who's that? That's juror number 10. And then from there, she's shut down by the judge. There's no discussion about what's in the declaration. There's no discussion about any of the applicant case law or 606 at all. I just summarily tells her that she cannot call this juror.
The defense counsel was totally blameless for saying, and I want her to testify how the statement affected her.
No, she's not. The declaration.
So
what
why
she
can't
intended
the judge take that into consideration? That's what the defense attorney's asking, and you know that that's not appropriate.
Well, the record doesn't show that he took any of that into consideration or 606.
Okay, assuming he did because she said it.
Right.
Okay. Why would that be inappropriate for a judge to say you want these two things? I'm not going to. You want her to testify that the statement was made and that it affected her?
I think that what she's saying is, in filing the motion for the new trial, is that this is in the interest of justice. We have an allegation that the jurors considered something that was not in the evidence, that they disregarded the jury instructions. I think once that's a very serious allegation that goes to the right to a fair trial. At that point, it merits at least some discussion and some hearing. And with regards to the comments on whether or not it tilted the scales, I think it's apparent from the jury instruction, I'm sorry, the jury communication, that well, that was one of the very paramount issues that the jury first considered when it went into deliberations, whether or not the petitioner and the other protected person stood in the same shoes. And there was no other evidence. They never called, the state didn't have any transcript of the proceeding, didn't call the first person, Mr. Williams, who read the order to him in order to explain, and what was explained to him, to Mr. Albregano at that hearing. So I think, and especially at that crucial point, I think it's very possible that those comments could have contributed to the conviction in this case.
What if the judge, instead of saying, Mr. Prosecutor, isn't this covered on page one of the exhibit, what if the judge had said, witness, isn't this covered on page one of the exhibit?
No. In my mind, I don't think, especially in front of the jury, that would have, you know, and this.
That would have been part of the evidence, right?
Yes, I guess so.
Wouldn't that be a comment on the evidence, though?
I think it still would be, Your Honor, because it went to, you know, what we said in, well, this court said in Creel and in Tanaka, it went to the very core of what the defense was in this case.
What if the judge simply said, isn't this covered on the exhibit, rather than referring to page one?
Maybe in that case it wouldn't have been, Your Honor, it,
actually, the thing is, we only know from context that the judge considered the minors to be covered under Section 3B and B3 and 3B4. Technically, there's nothing wrong with isn't this covered on page one, because page one outlines who the petitioner is and who the other protected people are.
That's correct. And I'm sorry to keep going over this again, but it was at the juncture where the state was trying to elicit evidence that would have negated the mistake of fact at that point.
But the problem is, by referring to page one, you don't refer to all the other pages, and it's all the other pages that create the, I call it ambiguity. Justice McKenna says clearly they're not covered, and I agree, actually. And so when you refer the person to page one, which is the title, it's a completely different result than the other pages. So we are talking context, and the context in this case is highly significant.
What's the significance of having those other people on the front page? They're called petitioner identifiers.
I think it's under the other protected persons. What is the significance of having them on there?
Other protected persons.
Yeah, well, there's a section that has to deal with, and this is just my opinion, but there's a section that deals with contact, and they are protected under that subsection of the order. They are protected. Mr. Albregano wasn't to have any contact with those people, and they were specifically listed in, under the order. And, you know, I know I've gone far into my rebuttal time now, and you know, I just...
Anything else to wrap up?
Just to wrap up, you know, in the motion for Rule 48, the court never invited any comment or any argument from the state, even though it was their burden. During the motion for mistrial and the motion for judgment of acquittal, the state's remained silent. Court didn't invite any argument, even at the motion for a new trial. And the court, in every instance, pretty much alleviated the prosecutor and the state of their burden in this case. And we all know what a fair trial looks like and what it reads like, and it's not what's in these transcripts. So we're asking that this court vacate the conviction and this court be remanded to the circuit court with instructions to dismiss with or without prejudice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.